Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is Side 2 of For the Record Program Number 634, Update on September 11th and Related Matters. This program is being recorded on May 18th of the year 2008. And once again, let me encourage people who only listen to the For the Record programs to take the plunge and use the vast supplemental information that's available online. The vast amount of printed information available on the Spitfire website at spitfirelist.com. The vast amount of information available on the For the Record blog sphere. And also the vast amount of information available on the For the Record supplemental section as well. WFMU and Spitfire have huge amounts of information available on audio file. The entire For the Record series is made available courtesy of WFMU. So if you only listen to the show on the radio or on internet radio, please do take the plunge, because at this point that is the smaller portion of the For the Record experience. One of the things that is not only inhibiting the struggle against Islamo-fascist terror and against its underground Reich allies and sponsors, one of the things that's doing that is the fact that increasingly, as I've discussed in, among other programs, For the Record 560 and 561, there is a huge global transfer of wealth taking place from everything and everybody into the coffers of the oil-producing companies and the oil-producing states. And the result of the reinvestment of that capital is the gradual Islamization to a point of an awful lot of the rest of the world. That's one of the reasons why the European nations and the UN abstained from weighing in on the undemocratic, unconstitutional, and frankly altogether unenlightened, and so far at least up to a point successful attempts by Muslim nations to institute their beliefs, or impose their beliefs on the rest of the world, whereas in Western industrial society, drawing caricatures of religious prophets is not considered in any way proscribed. Now the Islamist viewpoint is being imposed on the West. I've spoken in, among other programs, For the Record 613, about the fact that Prince Al-Walid of Saudi Arabia, one of the major investors in the world's media, has also been sinking large amounts of capital into various universities. A $20 million endowment at Harvard University took place after a Muslim, Mohammed Al-Arian, became the head of the Harvard Endowment Fund, the largest university endowment fund in the world. El-Arian came from PIMCO, a wholly owned subsidiary of Allianz, a German insurer, one of the German core corporations, one of the Bormann Capital Network's primary companies in the German economy, and also a company, not incidentally, that's being sued by the relatives of Holocaust victims for welching on insurance policies. Right after that, the Harvard University helped to sponsor the publication by Walton Mearsheimer of their Israel lobby book, and then Mohammed Al-Arian resigns from his position as head of the Harvard Endowment Fund and goes back to PIMCO, the subsidiary of Allianz. Something that didn't get a lot of notice was the fact that in order to help accommodate its Muslim students, a co-ed gym at Harvard, which had been open to use by both men and women, was closed to women out of deference to the male Muslim population. Likewise, a cafeteria that had been available to both genders was closed after a certain point so that Muslim students would not have to exist in the same environments as women, something that they did not want to do. And if people think that for example, the project discussed in For the Record 537, a Muslim Brotherhood program to turn the whole world Muslim, if people think that's far-fetched, well, just wait till the economy collapses completely and the only money that's available comes from the Middle East, and you're going to see a lot of things. Take a look at what's already taken place at Harvard. That's a bastion of higher learning, and let me tell you, a lot of things are going to be going down. Symptomatic of the reinvestment of oil money into economies in the West, and that's something that's having enormous implications. Abu Dhabi has bought a stake right here in the Silicon Valley in American Micro Devices, a very significant strategic high-tech company. This is an AP story that is datelined Sunnyvale, and this was from late 2008. I'll have the exact date for you. Late 2007, I should say. Actually, this is from December 11th of 2007. This article reads in part, its headline, Abu Dhabi buys stake in Sunnyvale-based AMD. It reads in part, with oil prices surging and U.S. stock prices slumping, chipmaker Advanced Micro Device Incorporated's sale of an 8.1% to the Abu Dhabi government's investment arm represents the latest plunge by a wealthy Middle Eastern nation into a troubled U.S. corporation. It also raises fresh questions about the appropriateness of Middle Eastern firms owning large chunks of U.S. businesses that specialize in advanced technologies. Sunnyvale-based AMD, the world's number two microprocessor maker, needs the $622 million investment from the Mubadala Development Company to help lift the company out of a deep financial slump. AMD has lost more than $1.6 billion so far this year and has just $1.5 billion in cash on hand as it works to pay down $5.3 billion in debt. The financial woes have caused AMD's stock to fall more than 35% since the start of the year, a slide that has wiped out nearly $4 billion in shareholder wealth. One of the interesting investments that has had enormous implications is the huge Muslim Brotherhood slash terrorist slash Islamo-fascist investment in PTEC, a high-tech company that makes the threat assessment software architecture for, among other agencies, the Air Force, the FAA, NORAD, the Department of Energy, which controls the nuclear power plants, and other sensitive government agencies. And there are very strong elements of overlap between the people who capitalized PTEC and the Muslim Brotherhood, elements behind Blind Sheikh Rahman, Abdullah Azzam, one of the founders of Hamas, a member of the Muslim Brotherhood who was Osama bin Laden's mentor. Perhaps the most significant name associated with PTEC was Yaqub Mirza. It was Yaqub Mirza who set up the institutions which were busted on the March 20th, 2002 Operation Green Quest raids, and yet Yaqub Mirza has never been indicted. Yaqub Mirza is, among other things, on very good terms with the FBI. He also is an investment partner of Kaiser and the Kaiser Economic Empire. So keep an eye on the reinvestment of petroleum wealth in this country, in the media, in sensitive corporations. Does not bode well. We're going to return to the book from which we read at the beginning of this broadcast. That book, again, is called Jihad and Jew Hatred, subtitled Islamism, Nazism, and the Roots of 9/11. It was authored by Matthias Kunzel, published in hardcover by the Telos Press, copyright 2007. And what we're going to do is to take a look at some examples presented by Matthias Kunzel of the Nazification of elements of the Arab and Muslim world. As I mentioned at the top of the broadcast, Matthias Kunzel presents a working hypothesis in this book that dovetails very precisely with the working hypothesis that I've been advancing about September 11th, since really before the event itself took place. And what we're going to do is to take a look at the phenomenon, not just of Islamo-fascism and of Muslim anti-Semitism, but we're going to take a look at the direct borrowing of Nazi anti-Semitic doctrine by contemporary Islamic fascists and the metamorphosis, or really the transference, of Nazi anti-Semitic doctrine into the contemporary Muslim world and the Muslim world of the Hitler period. I use the term Islamic fascist, which some people don't like, because I think it not only is appropriate, because the Muslim Brotherhood is an Islamic fascist organization. It works. The Islamic fascist milieu can only be understood as part of the world, basically the fascist international, as we looked at last week. But two, I think that from a practical standpoint, it offers a valid way of drawing distinctions between the bulk of the world's Muslim population, which is not fascist, and an awful lot of the rest of the world's Muslim population, which is, including, disturbingly, some of the most influential elements within the Muslim world. Saudi Arabia manifests very profound Islamic fascist outcroppings, and it is one of the wealthiest countries on earth. Others of the Arab oil-producing countries, manifest Islamic fascism, and indeed, when one examines contemporary jihadism, there are some very direct manifestations of Hitler-style anti-Semitism. And we're going to spend much of the rest of the broadcast at taking a look at the ongoing Nazification of much of the Arab and Muslim world. Turning now to some of the excerpts from Jihad and Jew Hatred, we're going to take a look at some of these. And again, I don't want to be misunderstood as characterizing all or most of the Muslim world as Nazi or fascist, but a lot of it is. And one of the things that's disturbing here is to see the legacy of Haj Amin al-Husseini, a general in the Waffen-SS, the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, and the first leader of the Palestinian National Movement, and an individual whose escape from Germany was, according to the Asia Times, effected in part with the assistance of Yosef Nada, the former Nazi spy, who was the head of the Bank al-Taqwa, an organization that intersects directly with the Republican Party and with the Bush administration. In Jihad and Jew Hatred, the author Matthias Kunzel cites an editorial that appeared in the second largest daily in Egypt in 2002. That's the government-controlled Al-Akbar. And speaking of the legacy of the Grand Mufti in contemporary Egypt, Kunzel writes, "Has Amin al-Husseini, the Mufti of Jerusalem who died in 1974, risen from the dead? Comments in leading Egyptian newspapers suggested that this might be so. Quote, with regard to this Holocaust swindle, many French studies have shown that this is nothing more than a fabrication, a lie, and a fraud," unquote, declared, for example, the Cairo columnist Fatma Abdullah Mahmoud on April 29, 2002. He continued, quote, but I personally complained to Hitler, even saying to him from the bottom of my heart, quote, if only you had done it, brother. If only it had really happened so that the world could sigh in relief without their, quote, the Jews, evil and sin, unquote. This heartfelt wish to see all the Jews at last annihilated was published in the country's second largest daily, the government-controlled Al-Akbar. And that is the source for that particular ripe observation. Some people may have just tuned in and thought they were listening to a fundraising pitch for Pacifica Radio. No, that was an editorial in the second largest Egyptian daily, the government-controlled Al-Akbar, from April 29th of 2002. Likewise, Syed Qutb, who is the number one ideologue, along with Muslim Brotherhood founder Hassan al-Banna, for the contemporary jihadists, and also, in particular, for Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda, as well as for Hamas, Palestinian Islamic Jihad, and others, Syed Qutb viewed Hitler as specifically having been sent by Allah to punish the Jews. Of Syed Qutb and his Nazi affiliations and sympathies, the author Matthias Kunzel writes, at the same time, the delusion of the Jewish world conspiracy is recycled in lurid tones. Quote, Jews in the latest era, unquote, have become, again quoting, the chiefs of the struggle with Islam on every foot of the face of the earth, Qutb claims. The Jews also utilize Christianity and idolatry in this comprehensive war. They attack every foundation of this religion in a crusader Zionist war. By the way, Qutb was executed in 1966, and this is his ideology is directly echoed in bin Laden's. In Qutb's eyes, the Jews are to blame for everything they have suffered over the centuries, and this applies to Hitler and the Shoah, too. Thus, in the modern period, quote, again quoting from Syed Qutb, the Jews again returned to evildoing, and consequently Allah brought Hitler to rule over them, unquote. But even the punishment, unquote, meted out by Hitler was not sufficiently terrible since, again quoting, once again today, the Jews have returned to evildoing in the form of Israel. So let Allah bring down upon the Jewish people the worst kind of punishment, unquote. Qutb's message is internally consistent. The Jew is the source of evil in the world. The Holocaust is therefore no crime, and Israel deserves to be erased from the map. Demonization of the Jews, legitimization of the Holocaust, and liquidation of Israel, three sides of an ideological triangle that cannot exist if any one of the sides is missing. Was Qutb's anti-Semitism a response to the foundation of Israel shortly before this essay was written? Not at all. The target of his hatred of the Jews is the threatening side of modernity, with which he identifies them. And again, Syed Qutb, along with Hassan al-Banna, the most important ideologues of the contemporary jihadists and the Muslim Brotherhood's outcroppings in particular. More from Matthias Kunzel's Jihad and Jew Hatred. What we're going to look at here is the Nazi-style anti-Semitism being manifested by some of the leading authorities at Gaza's Islamic University. Of course, Gaza is currently under the stewardship of Hamas itself, an outcropping of the Muslim Brotherhood. And turning to Jihad and Jew Hatred, we read, "To this day, it seems virtually impossible to graduate from Gaza's Islamic University without becoming an anti-Semite." Quote, "Lies have been revealed about murdered Jews in the Holocaust," unquote, declared Dr. Issam Sisalem, a history professor at the university, in a broadcast on a Palestinian Authority television channel in November of 2000. Quote, "Of course, all this is lies and unjustified assertions. No Chelmno, no Dachau, no Auschwitz. This was about disinfection facilities," unquote. And again, this from one of the leading professors at Gaza's Islamic University. Still more in this regard, again, and this sort of sentiment, sadly, is only too characteristic of an awful lot of the mentality that is currently being exhibited by the Palestinians, and it's one of the things that is not getting a lot of attention. It's also one of the major sticking points in I really can't use the term peace process without laughing a grotesque laugh. It reminds me of Nietzsche's statement, "A joke is the epigram on the death of a feeling." There is no bloody peace process at work. How dare I say that? Well, let's try the following. Turning to Kunzel's text again, "How unremarkable it is even today for Hitler-style anti-Semitism to imbue an Egyptian religious textbook is demonstrated by the standard text, The People of Israel in the Quran and Sunnah by Sheikh Mohammed Syed Tantawi." And by the way, Tantawi is noted here as the highest Sunni Muslim theologian. Continuing, "Tantawi is the head of Cairo's Al-Azhar University, which means he is one of Sunni Islam's most renowned spiritual authorities. The fourth edition of his book, it was also his PhD thesis, written in 1967, appeared in 1997. In it, Tantawi writes that the Jews were behind the French and Bolshevik revolutions, that they provoked the First and the Second World Wars, that they control the world's media and economy, that they endeavor to destroy morality and religion and run brothels worldwide. Tantawi, the highest Sunni Muslim theologian, quotes Adolf Hitler's remark in Mein Kampf that, quote, in resisting the Jew, I am doing the work of the Lord, unquote. And again, that from one of the highest ranking, according to one statement made here, the highest ranking Sunni theologian. Youssef al-Qaradawi, who is an advisor to the Bank al-Taqwa, is yet another who speaks in this vein. We've talked about him before. We're not going to discuss him in this particular broadcast, but rather it's worth noting the extent to which Holocaust denial and also endorsement of Adolf Hitler is something that is at the very foundation of an awful lot of Palestinian ideology and political culture at this point. Turning again to Jihad and Jew Hatred, the Yassin here is Ahmed Yassin. He is the founder of Sheikh Yassin is the founder of Hamas, now deceased. Arafat, of course, is Yasser Arafat. And in this book, Matthias Kunzel goes into the Nazi and German affiliations of Yasser Arafat, as well as his background in the Muslim Brotherhood. Secondly, for Yassin and Arafat, the subject of the Holocaust, the central experience in the establishment and attitudes of the State of Israel has remained taboo, as has that of the role of the Mufti in National Socialism. No post-Oslo Palestinian Authority schoolbook so much as mentions Auschwitz. When a Palestinian Authority official asked that this be changed, he was met with furious protests and the request was rejected. The chairman of the Palestinian Parliament's Education Committee declared that, quote, we have no interest in teaching the Holocaust, unquote. His parliamentary colleague and Fatah leader Hatem Abed al-Kadar added that teaching about the Holocaust would present a, quote, great danger, unquote, for the Palestinian identity. Again, quoting, If such a decision about teaching the Holocaust is made, it will undoubtedly ruin the Palestinian dream and aspirations. It will entirely obliterate the past, present, and future of the Palestinians, unquote. Not the slightest danger to the Palestinian identity, though, seemed to be presented by the circulation with express Palestinian Authority approval of Hitler's programmatic work, Mein Kampf, which reached number 6 in the Palestinian Territory's bestseller list in 1999. The translator of the Arabic edition of Mein Kampf refers in his introduction to his author's continued relevance, quote, Adolf Hitler does not belong to the German people alone. He is one of the few great men who almost stopped the motion of history, altered its course. National Socialism did not die with the death of its herald, rather, its seeds multiplied under each star, unquote. While the Palestinian Authority sows the seeds of National Socialism in this way and reaps a harvest of murderous anti-Jewish actions from it, Israeli policy is presented in all its media as a continuation or even intensification of Nazism. The constant equation of Israeli and National Socialist policies, Nazism of the Jews, Nazi-like enemy, Nazi Zionist practices, unquote, amounts to a specific form of Holocaust denial, one which legitimizes the pursuit of an anti-Jewish extermination policy while projecting these murderous intentions onto the chosen victim. And still more about the direct manifestation of Nazism in the contemporary Arab and Muslim world. And again, note here the introduction to the Palestinian Territories edition of Mein Kampf, which reached number 6 on its bestseller list in 1999. And I'm going to reiterate this. Adolf Hitler does not belong to the German people alone. He is one of the few great men who almost stopped the motion of history, altered its course. National Socialism did not die with the death of its herald. Rather, its seeds multiplied under each star. What he's basically saying, and not even between the lines, he's basically saying that he views his and his brethren's activities as basically a continuation of the Third Reich. And sadly, he has plenty of company in this particular regard. This specific Nazi-style anti-Semitism manifested itself through September 11th. Recall that we began the broadcast by taking a look at Hitler's plan to use the Daimler-Benz America bomber, a huge four-engine plane, to strap a bunch of little suicide kamikaze aircraft, which were going to fly to New York and crash themselves into some of the skyscrapers in New York and bring them down, this specifically to punish the Jews in their capital, unquote. And that specific style, Nazi style of anti-Semitism, was manifested by the September 11th hijackers. Recall that in the heroic work of Daniel Hopsicker, also in Among Other Programs for the Record 336, we took a look at the fact that Mohammed Atta was anything but alone in South Florida. He was associated with Germans and Austrians, including Wolfgang Boehringer. And talking of the Nazi-style anti-Semitism of the September 11th hijackers, the accused Munir al-Motesadeq had been a close friend of Mohammed Atta, the ringleader of the 9/11 hijackers. One witness, Shahid Nichols, a member of Mohammed Atta's core group between 1998 and 2000, said the following, quote, Atta's Weltanschauung, his worldview, was based on a national socialist or Nazi way of thinking. He was convinced that the Jews, unquote, are determined to achieve world domination. He considered New York City to be the center of world Jewry, which was, in his opinion, enemy number one. The trial in Hamburg also brought to light the second delusion underlying the Islamist view of America, that Jews control all the levers of American power. Thus, Shahid Nichols testified about the assailant's core group that, quote, they were convinced that Jews control the American government as well as the media and the economy of the United States. Motesadeq shared Atta's attitude in believing that a worldwide conspiracy of Jews exists. According to him, Americans want to dominate the world so that Jews can pile up the capital, unquote. Well, of course, you know, there's a lot of truth to that. The thing that makes the Jews so sneaky and so powerful is they control all that oil. There's those Jewish oil companies and the fact that Israel controls all of the oil. Now, if the poor Arabs only had any oil, well, they wouldn't get pushed around by this Jewish conspiracy. But, of course, that's not true. The Jews control all of the oil, right? Well, but of course, what else could be the case, right? Again, I can't recommend strongly enough, if people think that anti-Semitism and the kind of blood enmity that currently manifests itself in the Middle East is necessarily what has to have taken place there. Indeed, Marius Kunzel's book points out that there is not that traditional enmity between Jews and Muslims. There is some anti-Semitism in the Quran, all right, but that the current manifestation of Nazi-style anti-Semitism within the jihadist community and an awful lot of the Arab and Muslim world, it comes from the Third Reich and the Muslim Brotherhood. And again, I think this very small but very scholarly, densely and rigorously documented book is well worth the reading. Again, it's the main body of the text is only 162 pages, not including bibliography and index. Well worth the read, and it dovetails very, very closely with the hypothesis I've been presenting. By the way, the author, as will inevitably be charged by people, is not only not a Zionist, but he isn't even a Jew. In fact, he's not only a German Gentile, but he's the son of ardent supporters of Adolf Hitler. His father fought on the Western Front right up to the end of the war, and his family profited handsomely from the Third Reich. And it was his reading of his father's letters and his family's letters from World War II that spurred him to begin studying fascism and Nazism, and ultimately resulted in this book. And Marius Kunzel writes, "Neither the Grand Mufti nor the founders of the Muslim Brothers were creations of European fascism. However, both were strengthened by it. Like an elder brother, National Socialism had backed the fledgling Islamist movement up with catchwords, intellectual encouragement, and money. With the Cairo Jewish trial, unquote, the Nazis had exported their anti-Semitism to Egypt. Egyptian movements such as Young Egypt modeled their street processions on the Nazi mass marches. The Muslim Brotherhood got financial support from the German news agency in Egypt. Again, it was thanks to supplies of money from the Nazis that the Mufti was able to sustain the uprisings in Palestine, which al-Banna then used to boost the formation of his jihadi movement." We find similar roots, by the way, with the Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini. Not only is was Ayatollah Khomeini very, very close to Ahmed Huber of the Bank al-Taqwa, he was very close to Francois Janoux. And he, too, was strongly influenced by the Third Reich. We conclude with this passage from Jihad and Jew Hatred. "In 1937, when he was already an influential figure, Khomeini had linked up with the representatives of the Muslim Brotherhood. He began to read Hassan al-Banna's writings and discussed with the Brotherhood's emissaries for days on end. Khomeini would later make a special point of listening regularly to the Farsi language broadcast put out by the Nazis from Radio Zaysen. Germany's Persian service was during the war to enjoy the widest possible audience in Iran and Iraq. Khomeini listened to the programs every evening," unquote, wrote Amir Tahiri in his biography of the Iranian leader. Again quoting, "Khomeini had brought with him a radio receiver set made by the British company Pi, which he had bought from an Indian Muslim pilgrimage. The radio proved to be a good buy. Many mullahs would gather at his home, often on the terrace in the evenings, to listen to Radio Berlin as well as the BBC." And again, his disciple, Khomeini's disciple, Ahmadinejad, holding a Holocaust denial conference, networking with European neo-Nazis and people like David Duke, and also, according to a number of sources, including European intelligence or British intelligence, China, who has testified to this effect in the United Nations, they're going for nuclear weapons. Now, doesn't that make you feel good about the future? Sure makes me feel good. This concludes For the Record program number 634, Side 2, update on 9/11 and related matters. This has been recorded on May 18th of 2008. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.